You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. Did you ever do any research on dyslexia and how memory comes into play, or visualization where the letters get jumbled or turned upside down? Did you ever research
that? No, I never got into it again. You know, I'm not a doctor and I don't want to be one, but I've had people tell me that I'm probably the best expository writer there is, meaning the best teacher in writing. And I mentioned that not because it feeds my ego, which of course it does, but because my dyslexia helped me there. You see, I think the reason I am a good teacher is because there are no ambiguities in my writing. In other words, I teach as if everybody is like me, Michael. That's what started my first book in magic, which you might find interesting. It's called Close Up Card Magic, and it was written in 1962. Because I was so interested in card magic, and I started to read these books, and I would read something, and I'd say, wait a minute, does he mean the left hand or the right hand? Does he mean this finger or that finger? Does he mean the deck face up or face down? In other words, there were ambiguities, and I said to myself one day, you know something? I can do it better. And I did, because there are no ambiguities in my writing, because, to repeat myself, I write as if everybody's like me. I make sure that my writing is understood.
I understand that. Take me back to your first product, the audio tapes, or your first course, other than a book. How did that occur? Was it with a publisher? Did you self-publish? And then don't let me forget, I want to hear about the books that Gene Schwartz published.
Yeah, they're not that important. And when you say audio, I have audios right now of Ageless Memory, which the publisher said, we want you to talk it, Harry, instead of getting somebody else. I said, fine, nobody's going to emphasize the words correctly like I will, you know. But there are very little audios out there that I know of. Random House, I think, sells two audios of mine. One is just called How to Improve Your Memory. One is called How to Remember Names and Faces.
Well, back then, your course, you had the books going. When was your first course developed, the full-on course?
You're talking about the Memory Power course?
Yeah.
Here's what happened, Michael. I was getting so busy, mostly with corporations. In other words, quite honestly, that's what I do now. I do corporate work. You know why? They're probably the only people that can afford me at this stage of my life and my career. Because I have the money, obviously. Incidentally, many corporations all over the world use my systems as part of their regular training course. To this day, I did it many years ago when we did videos in those days for them. They still use them. But most of the speaking engagements I do now, and I take only the ones that I can't refuse. Because, you know, I told you my age. I'm tired. I'm semi-retired, Michael. I still do it just because I'm a ham, and I like to hear applause, and I like standing ovations, okay? I admit those things. I like it. So, okay, what started to happen years ago when I was very busy, when I was younger, is that it was much more than I could handle. So what I did was I took a few people who I knew, and I taught them how to teach my system. I taught them how to be instructors for the Harry Lorraine Memory Course, and I would send them out to corporations. And what started to happen, and I have letters, just a year or two ago, I took a warehouse full of letters and got rid of them. But from corporations saying, Harry, Mr. So-and-so is very good, but we want you. Now, that's fed my ego, Michael. I can only be at one place at a time. My wife won't agree to that, but I can only be at one place at a time. So that's what started the Memory Power course. Because somebody said to me years ago, Harry, if only you could bottle your systems, what a boon to society that would be. And that's what I did. I bottled them. Of course, as I always say when I talk about it or write about it, you got to do something. You got to uncork that bottle. In other words, you got to spend a few bucks and you got to buy my Memory Power course. But what I did is I put it all in program learning course. There's a manual, but more important, there's me on 5 CDs. Me personally doing the teaching, and 2 DVDs of me teaching numbers and names and faces. And that was something the corporation started to buy.
Now, was this course published under one of your book publishers or under
your own company? This is my own company. When you go to harrylorraine.com, that's where you'll learn about the Memory Power.
Where could one of our students, if they're interested in getting your memory course, what website could they find it?
That's it, harrylorraine.com. That's Harry, you know how to spell, H-A-R-R-Y, then Lorraine, LORAYNE.com. I have another website called Memory Improvement. That might be easier to remember. It's memoryimprovement.org, O-R-G. It's a different thing. It gives you a little bit of the history of memory and about me also, you know, personal. But you can contact me from that. I think if you click on the picture or something like that, you can find out about the Memory Power. power course.
Okay, I've got a question. You've got this publisher and you wanted to create your own course. Was that something that you had to give them first right of refusal of in your contract? Because it was a different category of a product, you could do it on your own and self-publish.
What are you talking about, the memory power course?
Yes, the memory power course.
Oh, no, there's nobody has any control of that. Listen, I have people all over the world who have ripped me off. All they have to do is change the dialogue, change the words, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Well, I'm saying from when you decided to put together the memory power course, yes. Were you beholden from your publisher? Like, they didn't have you tied up in a contract where you had to approach them first and say, hey, guys, I want to put a course together?
No, no way at all.
But if you wanted to do another book, you may have had to do that, right?
No, Ageless Memory, I sold to one publisher. Like I say, as long as I change the concept, as long as it's not word for word, I haven't for the last, I don't know how many decades, signed any contract where any publisher has the option for my next book.
Okay, so now you're your own self-publisher. Your course was under your own business.
Yes, but that's different than a book, Michael. That's the most important thing there are, the CDs and the DVDs. Any regular book, I won't publish, not in the memory area. Magic, yes, I self-publish my own magic books, but not the memory books, not for the public. That I want a regular publisher who has the distribution and it can set up the publicity, etc., etc.
So how'd it go with the courses? Now you had something that sold more than a book. You had more margins. How was the money on the actual courses?
That's a little more expensive than a book. People can buy my books for what? I don't know, $29.95. The memory power course is $150 plus the shipping and handling. It comes out to about $164. But I have letters from people who have that course, like I say, save their lives. So that becomes unimportant. The cost becomes unimportant, really. It's what do you gain that's important.
We have a lot of students who are into information products, okay? They're
right.
Into self-publishing. So they self-publish a book, they get a literary agent, they get a publisher, and they make a small royalty, but
yeah.
The publisher gets you, you know, a lot of exposure. But now you're an entrepreneur, and maybe you want to make more money. You create an information product, a course that maybe adds more value, some CDs, some audio training from the man himself. You've got more margins, and you're controlling and you're keeping all the money. So from a business standpoint of an information product developer, what could you tell the students in your experience how that was different? Was it good? Was it better money than the books? You know, from a business standpoint, what could you add about that?
Well, it's better money because you charge much more for something like that, and that's the way it should be because you're getting, I call it the closest thing to personal instruction that you can get from Harry Lorraine, it quotes. If you think personal instruction from Harry Lorraine is important, then that's what you get. Although people tell me that when I write, they learn the same way. That's fine. That's up to the individual which way you want to go. I would not do a book that way. The memory power course is entirely different. The book is okay, but the CDs and the DVDs are the important things. But if I do another memory book, I would certainly go to a publisher. First of all, I like it better for a variety of reasons. Number one, they're going to give me an advance of many thousands of dollars if they want to use my name.
If a publisher really wants you and you've got something hot, what kind of advances in the publishing world are some of these publishers willing to put up front?
I can only go by me. Nowadays, I think with the economic situation, it's not going to be that way. But I got $100,000 for my last book. Listen, my first book, I told you, I got $500, and I was scared out of my mind because I thought I'd have to give it back if the book didn't make it. You know, I learned that that's not refundable. But then as time went by for the memory book, which became a vast bestseller, I only got $20,000. But because of the great success of that, the memory book, because it was on the New York Times bestseller list for a year, my second book after that, Remembering People, got a $500,000 sale in paperback.
This would be fun. Okay, you've got a lot of students listening. I mean, one could only dream of getting $100,000 for an advance on a book. I want you to take me back to the day, the time. How did this all work? Did your literary agent call you and say, Harry, okay, just sit down. They want to give you an advance, and then he tells you how much it is. Can you recount that story? I know it's no big deal to you, but imagine all the students who want to self-publish and become a successful publisher with expertise that they have. What does it look like when you learn that a publisher wants to give you $100,000 advance on a book? Was that exciting to you?
Well, of course, but that's not self-publishing, Michael. Self-publishing is when you do it yourself.
Okay, you're right. I made a mistake. Not self-publishing.
Yeah, no, I self-publish my magic books. Look, I've written a memoir that I did some years ago. I told you Mel Brooks told me to call it a re-memoir. But I did it originally. I wrote it for the public, but I have not gotten the kind of offer, the kind of advance that I will accept. Now, that sounds silly. because they were pretty high, thousands of dollars, but nowhere near what I used to get for my training books. And I would love to get that money, but I can't. It would be bad business, because it's like years ago when an agent called me. This is when I was not that well known before my books. And he said, Harry, I got a B'nai B'rith, but I was getting, let's say, $100 or $150 in those days for an appearance. And he said, they can only afford $75, but Harry, I'm trying to break him in as a client. Can you do it for me as a favor? Blah, blah, blah. And I said, oh, okay, for you, Henry. The agent was named Henry Stern. And I did it for him for $75. Now, go forward a couple of months, and Henry Stern calls me, and he said, Harry, I got a job for you. Are you free such and such a date? Yes. I'll give you $75. I said, wait a minute, Henry. My fee is $150. He said, but Harry, you did it for $75 for me last May. That's why you got to be careful. In other words, I will not accept the offers I've gotten for my memoir, because later when I want to do a book, if I'm still around and I want to do a book on, you know, memory training, they're going to say, oh, but you accepted only so much for that. I can't do that.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. What has been the most rewarding things about your career in the whole memory education and training business?
Are you talking money-wise?
It could be money or whatever.
Well, money. The biggest amount was somebody bought Remembering People for $500,000.
Remembering People, I mean, obviously that was your work, but was that self-published?
No, no, no. None of the memory books are self-published.
Well, okay, what do you mean they bought it for $500,000?
They bought the paperback rights from Saul Stein for $500,000.
Oh, I see.
This was a different company, Warner Books. They paid Saul Stein $500,000 for the paperback rights of Remembering
People. Is that worldwide paperback rights?
Oh, yeah.
How many languages are your books in?
The last time somebody counted for me, they told me 18 they knew of that they could find. But, you know, that's another whole story. I remember somebody sending me a book from Taiwan. It was like an onion skin paper. It was terrible. He said that he had to smuggle out. I didn't know this. If they see a book in your suitcase when you come out of Taiwan, they confiscate it. They don't let you take books out because they're all crooks there. So this guy showed me one of my books. I don't even know which title it was. Doesn't matter. But it was my book, word for word. It said my name on it, but they printed it and they sell it. They don't pay any royalties. They just steal it.
What's your advice on someone who's deciding, should I go the self-publishing route and sell the book myself on my particular expertise, or try and land a deal going through a literary agent or approaching publishers today?
My feeling is if you can get a literary agent and if he can sell your book, you're much better off. But I'm thinking individually. I'm thinking of myself. I know how to sell a book in magic because it's a very small area. I take a few ads in magic magazines, etc., you know, and it's done. I wouldn't know how to sell my own book if I self-published a book on memory that is really my expertise and which is what the world knows me for. I wouldn't know how to sell it. I wouldn't know how to set up a publicity tour. Listen, I went out for the memory book. I did 37 cities in one trip. You know what I mean? I couldn't do it.
You need a team.
I need people who are expert in that areas that set up your publicity and get you your flight tickets and your hotel rooms and all that kind of stuff. I couldn't do that. So to answer your question, I could only answer it for me. I would never want to self-publish in the memory area. In the magic area, yeah, I write the book. I have it printed myself. I run a few ads. I have a whole email list of magicians, like 8,000 of them, that I email a copy of the full-page ad, and I get all these orders. I'm involved in that right now. I don't even have my book shrink-wrapped. You know why? Because most people want my books autographed. So before I realize that, I have to sit and cut off shrink-wrap. So, A, it saves me money because I'm not paying for shrink wrap. B, I don't have to cut shrink wrap off my books in order to autograph the books.
How about Shorts? How did it end up where he published a couple of your books? Tell me how that occurred.
You know, I don't even know how he worked it up with Frederick Fell, because in those days I was under option to Frederick Fell. But Gene Schwartz and Fred Fell were like partners with my books anyway. So he must have worked something out. He said, Harry, I want to publish so-and-so. And he took some of my older books and he put them into programmed learning. He didn't. He told me to do it. But I didn't even know what programmed learning meant. But it ended up, I'm very good at it. But it's not a very popular thing now. The book in my memory power course is programmed learning. What programmed learning is, it's taught in frame form, in numbered frames. In other words, frame one, and you answer questions. Either you fill in a blank or you have multiple choice. And the way it makes it work, at least the way I do it, I want to make sure that the student always answers correctly. The because they have what's called an autoproctor mask. They pull it down to see if their answer is correct. I want to make sure they get it correct all the time, because I learned years ago, if people keep saying the wrong thing three or four times, they say, to heck with it, I can't do this.
Okay, interesting. So Schwartz ended up publishing, which two titles did he publish?
One was called The Memory Isometrics Course, which was basically how to develop a superpower memory, but in program learning form. The next one was for the second book, The Program Learning Format for Secrets of Mind Power. Those things are all long out of print, incidentally, Michael. You know, I'm going to give you another website. I don't know if your people are interested. Somebody put this together for me because they said, you know, Harry, there's no website selling your magic stuff. You know, years ago, I got to tell you this, Michael, I was very careful about mixing magic and memory. I didn't want the world to think, it's all a trick, you know?
Yes.
So I was very careful about that until one of my books, Frank Fields, I don't know if you know the name Frank Fields, he was the weather guy for NBC for many years, and he was very well known, and he was like a fan of mine, and he read my book, and they got a quote from him for this particular book, and it was on the back jacket in big print. He called my systems a trick. He said, these are the greatest tricks you will ever learn on how to train your memory, and he used the word tricks. The world didn't change or anything, and then I wrote the memory book, and in my foreword of the memory book, I did something purposely. I wrote that I had started as a card manipulator. That's the way I started. And I wrote that because I wanted to see what would happen. You know what happened, Michael?
Nothing.
The sky didn't fall down around me.
They didn't care. They just want to know how to do it for themselves.
There you go. It just didn't matter.
Harry, how did you go from being a very good card manipulator to memory? Where is this connection?
What a good question that is, Michael. Listen, I thought that my living was going to be magic cards. You know, I had my own television show back in 1951 called The Professor Magic Show that my wife and I wrote. The whole concept of the show, and this is very funny, I was 19 or 20 years old, and I was a retired magician that owned a candy store. The reason for that was because the sponsor was a candy manufacturer. So I owned a candy store so the camera could pan on all his products. And the whole point was that once a week, this was the concept of The Professor Magic Show, once a week I had the children from the neighborhood come in and I would do magic for them. But I was supposed to be a retired magician that opened the candy store. So they grayed my hair. They made me wear glasses. I had perfect eyesight in those days that had just regular glass in them. And I had to act like an older guy. I looked like a young guy with gray hair and phony glasses. But it was a very popular show. In any case, the reason I'm telling you that is I thought magic was going to be my livelihood. And then one day, I was very friendly with a guy by the name of Richard Himber. Richard Himber was a musician and also a magician. He was a very well-known musician of his day. And he was a good friend of mine and always tried to help me out. And I was down in the dumps and he said, what's the problem, Harry? I said, I can't get any work doing magic. There are other people doing close-up magic in restaurants. He whistled for a cab and he took me to Billy Reed's Little Club. Billy Reed's Little Club was on 55th Street near Park Avenue. In those days, New York was a late night kind of place, you know, till 4 in the morning, people were going out and drinking and whatever. He took me there, and long story short, he made me meet Billy Reed, who I thought owned the place, but I found out that he worked for people with crooked noses and cauliflower ears, just strange people. But anyway, he managed the joint. Long story short, he hired me, and I did table magic. You know, there was a tent card, they called it, on every table. Call Harry Lorraine if you want to be amazed, you know, 10 fingers of magic, etc., etc. In that kind of club, Frank Sinatra used to come in, and he only carried $100 bills. So when he tipped you, it had to be a $100 bill. So it was good, and I was paying Billy Reed 20% of everything over $400 I made. So even if I didn't make it, I gave him money because I wanted the job. Now, why am I telling you this? One day, in comes Victor Jory. This was my life at that time, doing table magic, and I was very good at it, mostly card stuff. Now, I don't know if you know the name Victor Jory, popular actor at the time, and in the movie Miracle Worker, he played Helen Keller's father. He was a very popular actor. Anyway, he came in, and he was interested in magic, and he had me come over, and I did some stuff for him, and then he comes in a few days later bringing in a friend, and he says, I want you to do some of this stuff, and then he kept coming in, maybe 8 times, he came in with different people, which was very nice, you know, always asking for me, and I would always try to do at least 1 or 2 tricks with the cards that he hadn't seen yet, because I wanted to fool him, or entertain him. Well, I was very young. I started to get to the bottom of the barrel. You know, now you give me a deck of cards, I go on forever because I keep inventing as I go along. But I couldn't do that then. I wasn't that knowledgeable. So I was getting to the point where I had nothing else to show him. So I said, I'll do a memory thing for him. I did a memory thing with cards, Michael, which I still do if I want to really impress somebody, which is very rare now, but I do occasionally, is I have somebody shuffle the deck and then they call him off to me pretty quickly. And when he's all through, I say, give me any number from 1 to 52. He says 23. I say, that's the Jack of Clubs. They check it, and sure enough, it is. Then I say, name any card. 4 of Diamonds, that's the 12th card. They check it, there it is. In other words, I prove that I've remembered where every card is in the deck by number, and then the ending was, what's your favorite hand in poker? I'd say a royal flush. I'd say, what suit? Did he say hearts? I'd say, fine. Look at the 5th card, 12th card, 13th card, 48th and 49th card, and they would look, and there was the royal flush. You know, 10, Jack, Queen, King, and Ace of Hearts. That was the effect I did.
I saw that trick on your website.
Yeah, I do something like it, yes. Anyway, reason I'm telling you this, I did that trick because I thought I was scraping the bottom of the barrel. I had run out of sleight of hand, you know, real magic card trick, so I did that. And talk about plot points. When I finished that trick with Victor Jory, he stood up and he started to applaud. And he said in a loud voice, because this was called a little club, it was a little club, everybody heard him, you know. He said, Harry, he said, all the card stuff you've done for me, this sleight of hand was great and terrific. I've never seen anything like it. But what you just did, and he started to rave about the memory, and that changed my life. Because then again, off goes the light bulb, and I say, wait a minute. If this is so great for him, I'm doing something wrong.
You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, that was a big plot point for me. That's when I started geared toward doing the memory work, and that's how I got it another way. I was into memory, as I told you, when I was 11 years old as a kid, but now I saw where the entertainment value was.
Do you gamble?
I can't in 6 places, I'm told.
Okay, so I want to talk about the relationship between your memory and cards, card counting and casinos.
First of all, I don't card count. You see, there's a difference. I remember the cards. First of all, you know, this is very important. You know, people ask me about this all the time. Let me tell you something. There are 6 casinos, I'm told, that will not deal to me in Las Vegas. Why? Because I'll sit down at the blackjack table and I will win. There's no question about it. I'm going to beat them. But it's work for me. It's a grind. Because what I used to do, I haven't done in years. After I finished at the blackjack table, I go to the crap table, which is more fun for me, and I lose it all back anyway. Don't you see? The blackjack, I love to do it because I like to win. And in my memory, I'm exercising my mind, etc., etc. But what I started to say, what's very important is that you know the game. And most people who go to Las Vegas or Monte Carlo, which I went to very often to gamble, I'll give you the anecdote. First of all, I started to tell you, I was playing this game, but we used to call it 21, on the mean streets, on the dirty sidewalks of the Lower East Side when I was 5 years old. So I know the game better than the dealers in casino, better than the owners at a casino. So knowing the game is important. For example, I'm working for an audience, and this has happened so many times. Somebody will say, oh, Mr. Lorraine, I need a blackjack, and I start to talk about blackjack, and I say, look, let me ask you all a question. Let me prove a point. Get this picture in your mind. You're sitting at a blackjack table. The dealer has a 5 showing. You know that he can show one card. You know that. He's got a face-down card and a face-up card, and let's say it's a 5 showing, and you have a soft 15. If you don't know what a soft 15 is, that's an ace and a 4. An ace and a 4 is 15. Here's my question. It comes your turn. Remember the situation. The dealer has a 5 showing. You have a soft 15. What do you do? Do you hit or do you stay? And let me tell you, whenever I did this for large audiences, 50% of the people would raise their hand when I said, would you hit? And the other 50% say they would stay. And then after it quiets down, I would say, you're all wrong. Now, do you know why?
No, I don't.
Okay. Because if you know the game, if the dealer's got a 5 showing, he is mathematically at his worst position. He usually has a 9 or a picture card there, and he's going to go out. You have a soft 15. Whatever you pull, you cannot go out. Even if you get a picture card, you'll end up with 15, right? And blackjack is the only game where in the middle of a hand, you can double your bet. And if you don't take advantage of that, then the odds are against you are very high. If you know how to take advantage of what I'm about to tell you, then you even up the percentage. What you do in a case like that, you've doubled down. In other words, if you've got $100 worth of chips in front that comes to you under the circumstances I just described, you put another $100 worth of chips there. He deals you one face down card and he goes to the next player. And the odds are you're going to win. But here's the point. Most people don't know that. So what I'm saying is you've got to know the game. Now, you ask me how do I apply it. The way I apply it is the enlargement of what I teach in every one of my books where I teach cards and what I call the missing card stunt. Dick Cavett does it all the time. He shows off that way. You can take five cards out of any shuffle deck and call off the rest of the deck as quickly as you want, and I'll tell you the five cards that are missing. It's like a Rain Man thing. As a matter of fact, I talked to Dusty Hoffman about that. It was very funny because he was the star of the movie Rain Man.
Did you ever meet the real Rain Man?
No. So I came to my house with his brother, who he said, his brother, I don't even know what that title is, remembers every day in his life and things like that.
That's the thought?
Yeah. But when it came down to remembering a deck of cards or remembering a long digit number, he couldn't do that at all, which I can, or any of my students can. Anyway, listen, I started to tell you before, let me get this off my mind, HarryLorraineMagic.com. HarryLorraineMagic.com, you can see what my current items are available, but also magic thing. Back to the blackjack, I don't count.
Did you ever have anyone approach you to do a book, or have you done a book on how to win at blackjack?
No, I wouldn't go into that, but I talk about it in the card section of a number of my books, yes.
Are you familiar with being in the magic publishing business? Who is it? Edward Thorpe, at a Beat the Casinos at 21.
I know the name, and I read the book 100 years ago, but I didn't go along with it, because I don't do that mathematical stuff. I go by averages. When they were dealing only one deck, I had them down pat. In other words, again, it's to know when to double down. I would be sitting at a blackjack table, and I've got 18 showing, and I double down, and people look at me like I'm crazy. But I knew that there are only twos, threes, and aces mostly left in the deck.
Let's say there's someone who's fanatic about card counting. As a blackjack player, and let's say you're going to go play blackjack with single-hand decks, where do you think you're going to come off better? Actually remembering the deck like you train in your courses, or doing a card counting system?
For me, it would be what I just told you, knowing what cards are left, because I don't know the card counting at all. You know, again, it's an individual thing, Michael. For me, I would never attempt that. I would never think of that. You know, I don't lose at blackjack. Never. Like I say, it's a grind. It's work.
It is work. How about, you know, in the casinos today, there's five shoes. You know, I mean, I can understand one deck. Could one remember what's left?
Only by average. That's what I meant when I said average. Because they don't go through a full deck, even if you're dealing with one deck. When you get down to near the bottom, they always take them out and reshuffle. So you go by average, and the averages work out. If I know that by the time they've gotten three quarters down that shoe with five or six decks in it, if I know there are more deuces and threes and aces left than anything else, that average usually works out.
Let's talk about your infomercials. Tell me about the first infomercial that was done. How did that all come about?
Well, I was called to do an infomercial, you know, and I flew to Arizona.
What stage in your career were you? About how old were you?
The first one was about 1992, and it was a very good infomercial. It became the number one infomercial in the country. I made a lot of money with it, but I didn't own it. The companies made a lot of money.
We've talked about literary agents and publishers doing a deal. How is an infomercial deal different?
This was a percentage. This was a 60-40 deal, and I was getting 60, they were getting 40.
60% of the net?
Yeah, after you deduct the cost of the product and the cost of the media. Don't forget, you're paying television companies a lot of money.
Is that a better deal than what you're going to get generally from a publisher?
Oh, yeah.
Who approached you on this?
This company called me and said, would you like to do this? Blah, blah, blah. We want to do something on memory. You're the only name we found. That was then. Now I got ripoffs all over the place. But I was the only one really known and doing this stuff. And we did it, you know, in one day. We shot the thing. I brought friends of mine from New York. They flew down to Arizona. When I say friends, I mean testimonial people, you know. There was one very important guy, and he was on my second infomercial also. Lieutenant Colonel Arthur Ballard, he wrote me a long letter that he was shot down over Vietnam, and they took away paper and pencil, etc., and he had hurt his back, and he was laying there with nothing to do, and he had just read one of my books, and what kept him sane, he said, was going over all my systems in his head, and then, listen to this, as he got better, they took away all writing implements, etc., he said there were other American soldiers, prisoners there, he started to tap on the walls in Morse code and teach my systems to the next door guy, who would then tap on his wall and teach it to the next guy. He said after a while, all the Americans were using my systems to remember psychology and music and mathematics and numbers, and he said, you helped keep us sane behind the bamboo wall, and thank you and God bless you and all that kind of stuff. He lived in South Carolina. He was retired, and they had him on film. They filmed him saying what I just told you. he ended by saying, "You are my hero," and I started to cry on television. Incidentally, there was a television show called To Tell the Truth. You remember that?
Yes, I do.
They saw this thing or read about it somehow. On the back of my book, the memory book, was part of his letter. Maybe that's where they saw it. And they called me and got in touch with him, and he was on that show, To Tell the Truth. The concept of that show, there were three people all claiming to be the same person. So after all the questions and answers, they said, "Now we have Harry Lorrainian with us, who will come and stand behind the real lieutenant." And, you know, I came out and he pretend to stand in front of one wrong person, and then you go behind the real guy. So they had him on television, etc., just because he sent me this lovely letter, how I saved his life behind the bamboo curtain in Vietnam.
Wonderful story. So have the infomercial go.
Oh, I'm knocking wood mentally. It was a tremendous success. Like I say, it was the number one infomercial in America for a long time. And then I did my own infomercial after that because, again, I didn't do options anymore. I wanted to do my own, that I owned it, and I did it. Dick Cavett was the host. Dick Cavett was a friend, became a friend because he's using my systems. He is quoted on the bottom of the dust jacket of Angels Furioso. He says, "You can use it, you can learn it, you can employ it, you'll be glad you did." That's Dick Cavett. So he was a friend, and he hosted the show.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Sinoff's hardtofindseminars.com. Did the first infomercial do better than your own infomercial?
Oh, my own did better. A, I had Dick Cavett hosting it. It was very well known at the time. He still is, but he was quite well known. And that one did better, yeah. I had a company called Positive Response took it over. Because, again, the company I originally did it with didn't know how to put it on television properly. So I had a company called Positive Response. They're out of business now. The guy that owned it died and went out of business. But they set up all the appearances, you know, running the show all over the place. Dick Cavett called me once. He said, "Harry, for God's sakes, I'm at a hotel in Missouri, and I just finished my talk, and I'm up here having a drink. I'm scanning the channels, and I just saw myself three times." Yeah, they were running it all over the place.
How many years did these infomercials run? How about the first one? How long did that run?
The first one ran for about a year, and the second one ran for about 2 years.
Did they run nationally?
Oh, yeah.
Did they run internationally?
No. You know, I remember somebody calling me about to translate it into Spanish. I don't think that ever happened.
When the infomercials started running, did that increase your notoriety? How did that affect your business?
Oh, sure. Oh, I started to get recognized walking in the street, because I'm telling you, it was all over the place in those days when they were running it. And sure, more people called me, you know, corporations, to come and teach their people or be their speaker for the evening. That's what I did mostly. Now I don't do that. I don't want to demonstrate anymore. I want to teach, because, for example, I don't want to go in and remember everybody's name anymore, because not that I can't do it mentally, but I can't do it physically.
Tell me about your introduction, how you got on Carson. Who got you on Carson? When was that? And how did that lead to being on 23 times?
Gee, I don't know how I got on originally, I guess. See, I'll tell you how I got on the first national show that I ever did. Was called I've Got a Secret. That was Gary Moore. Gary Moore endeared himself to me. What happened is, I couldn't get on any television show, and I was talking to somebody, and this somebody said, "You know, I know Chester Feldman." Chester Feldman was the producer of I've Got a Secret, which was a very hot live television show in those days. Do you know what the concept of I've Got a Secret was? There was a panel of three or four people, and somebody got on, and they asked him questions. They had to find out what was his secret. And this guy said, "I can get you an appointment with Chester Feldman." And he did. Long story short, I go up there. Chester wasn't too thrilled. He was sitting writing. I coughed until he looked. And he said, "Harry, what can I do for you?" I said, "Well, I want to be on I've Got a Secret." He said, "Well, what will your secret be? What will you do?" I said, "I'll remember the names of everybody in the audience, which is 400 people." And I saw, again, the curtain go over his eyes.
Yeah. You
know? Yeah, sure. And he said one of these cliches, you know, "All right, Harry, we'll call you." And in my mind, I said, "Yeah, sure, you'll call me." I said, "Look, Mr. Feldman, why don't you let me do it after your show one night? You know, they were on Tuesday nights, and I'll do it when you're not on television, you know, after your show." Then he looked up at me and he said, "You would do that?" I said, "Of course." So, long story short, that Tuesday, Gary Moore, before he goes on television, says, "Listen, folks, there's a man walking around asking you for your names. He is not with the Internal Revenue. Please, don't get frightened. Just give him your name. You're going to see what we're going to do with that after the show." And that's what he did, so people didn't get scared. because don't forget I wasn't well known then. So when I go over to somebody and excuse me, I just want to know your name, they want to know why. You know, they got a little frightened. So he made that little talk. Anyway, long story again, after the show, he introduces me. I say with the few people I met stand up, everybody stands up. I call them all by name as I call them, they're seated, till everybody is seated, and he says, Harry, you're on next week.
Wow. Were there 400 people?
400 people. That's what they told me. I don't count them. It scared the hell out of me if I counted them.
That's so many people. I mean, how do you process and come up with the trick so quickly and match them up to the face of the person?
That's one of the things I write about is by the time you shake hands in real life, by the time you shake hands, it should be done. If I meet a Mr. Bentavenia, by the time I stick out my hand that I've thought of Bentvane, and understand something, I'll give you another one of my cliches. Even if my systems don't work, they must work. And this is a good example, because in order for me to do what I just told you in a split second, I meet Mr. Bentavenia, and by the time I shake his hand, I'm thinking of a bent weather vane. Bent vane, because remember what I told you about the reminder principle?
Yes.
Because bent vane is going to remind me of Bentavenia. Not only that, Bentavenia is a conglomeration of sound. If you're not Italian, maybe it means something in Italian.
But how do you match it up to their face?
Well, that's what I'm trying to tell you. Now, by the time I shake hands, I've already thought of bent vane. Now, in order to do that, you know what you're forced to do? And most people will not understand this until I mention it and then say, oh, of course. In order for me to have come up with bent vane, I had to do something that most people, 99.9% of the people in the world, don't do, and that is listen to the darn name. Because how could I have come up with bent vane for Bentavenia if I didn't hear it in the first place? And that's so important because, you know, the universal memory complaint is I'm introduced to somebody and 2 minutes later I forget his name. And when people tell me that, and I've written this in books, I say that's a lie. You didn't forget his name. What you did is you didn't remember it in the first place, and I'll take it a step further back. You didn't hear it in the first place. No, and you know something? You're too busy looking around trying to see who in this room do I want to network with? Who do I want to impress? Never realizing that maybe the person you're not listening to right now may be the most important person in your life. You never know, do you? So anyway, in order to come up with the visible thing, I cannot visualize Bentavenia, but I can visualize a bent weather vane, you know, the thing on top of a roof with N-E-W-S on it. So by the time I shake hands, I've done that, and when I say even if my systems don't work, they must work, because I forced you to listen. That's the key. Okay, next thing, as I shake hands, I look at his face, and I pick out the most outstanding feature. First impressions are lasting impressions. The first thing I see, let's say I see a big nose. Let's say that's the first thing I see on Mr. Bentavenia's face. By the time I finish shaking hand, I visualize his face with a bent weather vane instead of a nose.
Got it.
That's it. Because the next time I see Mr. Bentavenia, the nose is going to be the outstanding feature. I see bent vane, and I say, hi, Mr. Bentavenia.
Okay, but you got 400 people. Everyone has an outstanding feature. Aren't you going to start mixing up the features?
No, because again, I have been forced to listen and concentrate. That's the key. Because, you know, I've written this in a book. I was once at a show. There were 17 Mr. and Mrs. Smiths in the audience. So it's the same question like you just asked me. All the same outstanding features. How about the same names? I don't care. Because to me, when I'm working and meeting people, each person is an individual. And that's very important also. And that's what I teach people. You're at a business meeting. You're not going to worry about 400 people. You're interested in 10 people. And you do exactly the same as I do, except I do it faster because I've been doing it for 60 years.
Have you ever screwed up and blanked out for any reason?
But I have ways to get out of it.
What do you think inhibits good memory for the public out there?
Very simple, not paying attention. That's the key. You've got to learn how to pay attention. It's what I call the slap in the face principle. You know, I told you before that Aristotle in one of his books said, in order to think, we must speculate with images. But there was something else Aristotle used to do that was very important when I read about it. He and Plato and Socrates, people like that, they were teachers. They used to teach one-to-one, you know, one person at a time. And one of the things I found out they did is, let's use Aristotle as the example, if he made a point, if he said something that he thought it was very important for the student to remember, you know what he did? He slapped their face. It's the slap in the face principle. And incidentally, that concept worked 1,000 years later or 2,000 or 3,000 years later when we were settling in the West here in America, because the guy who staked land, he would take his firstborn son when he was 12, you know, old enough to think, and he would take him and he'd say, here is the boundary. He wanted the boy to remember where the boundary of his land was, and he would take him to the boundary and he'd say, listen, look here, this is the boundary of the land. And as the kid looked, he'd slap him. Why? Because the kid never forgot that. He said, what are you doing, Dad? Now you'll never forget. This is where your land ends. So that slap in the face principle is very important. All it means is grasping attention. The problem, and I've written about this, so people who've read my books forgive the redundancy, that hurts. I'm too small to do that. So I had to develop a way to slap people in the face or teach you how to slap yourself in the face without pain. And that's where I teach how to make ridiculous pictures like I just demonstrated a little bit with Ben DeVania.
Fascinating. Okay, Johnny Carson.
When I did the I've Got a Secret thing, I started to become a little known. And then, another long story, I couldn't get on the Jack Parr show. And at one of my appearances, Boss Hart, may he rest in peace, he became a good friend. You know who Boss Hart is? He directed My Fair Lady, and he wrote a book called Act One. And he was very important. And he came to me, and he said, Harry, you have given me an evening. I'll never forget. What can I do for you? And without thinking, I said, get me on the Jack Parr show, because I couldn't get on it. And he did. He wrote a letter to Jack Parr. He said, if you don't put this guy on, I will never do your show again, blah, blah, blah. I got on the Jack Parr show. Around that same time, I did the Ed Sullivan show. That's another story where Richard Himba brought me to meet Ed Sullivan. And Himba used to get things off key a little bit off sync. He said to Ed Sullivan, Ed, this guy will remember everybody's name in the audience. And then when he calls the name, they'll all stand up till the whole audience is standing. He had it backwards. I do it the other way. I have everybody stand there. I seat them. So when he said to Ed Sullivan, this was at the Broadway Theater, where it's now called the Ed Sullivan Theater here in New York, when he said he'll call everybody's name, and as he calls them, they'll all stand till the whole audience is standing, Ed Sullivan said, and I'm quoting now, he said, Dick, I could have Ray Block play the Star Spangled Banner and get the same effect. I started to laugh. That was the end of that. A couple of weeks later, Bob Precht, who was Ed Sullivan's son-in-law, called me, and I got the show anyway. That's when I started to get known, and then I got a call to do the Johnny Carson show. Now, who called? I guess it was one of the talent coordinators.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. You remember that night specifically?
Yeah, they all start to blend. I got a picture of my wall. I'm looking at it right now. The last time they called me, I was sitting here, and the talent guy, we were talking, and he said, I got a picture of me and Johnny. Well, we both had jet black hair. We were smoking, which you don't do on television anymore. He said, oh, Harry, bring it. Johnny would love to see it. So I did. The talent agent said to me, you know, how do I know I was on 23 times? I don't keep those kind of records. The talent agent said to me, Harry, Johnny wants to mention how many times you've been on. I said, honestly, I don't know. He said, okay, we'll take care of it. Johnny mentioned that it was on 23 times. In other words, they counted it. I didn't. Anyway, he showed that picture of he and I when I was sitting in what they call the first chair, talking to him, and he said, let's pose. Let's do it again now. So I have those two pictures in a frame. They're about 28 years apart, with the top one, you know, with the black hair and smoking. The bottom one, we both have gray hair and not too much of it. So we got very friendly. You know, Johnny started doing magic, and that's one reason I guess he knew about me, and he became a big fan. He would come into the dressing room every time I was on it. Somebody once said to me, Harry, was that Johnny coming out of your dressing room? I said, well, yeah, like, what's the big deal? He said, no, Johnny doesn't go into anyone's dressing room unless he's a big fan. Well, I didn't know that. And he used to come into my dressing room all the time. He was the kind of guy, he knew my background, we were very friendly. Whenever I was in town, he would call me, we would get together, not on the show necessarily, but personally. And I'll give you another little vignette. He knew my background, okay? So when I was finished, I'm sitting in the first chair talking to him. He said, Harry, how many degrees do you have? Because he knew my background. And he said, Johnny, I only have 1 year of high school. And then we went on to something else, etc. And again, here comes that same call from Freddie Cordova. He said, oh, Harry, we've got so many negative pieces of mail and calls. I said, why? What the hell did I do now? He said, well, you said you only have 1 year of high school. He said, all these letters and calls we got, they all said basically the same thing. They said, we have enough trouble keeping our kids in school as it is. We don't need to see an obviously successful guy saying that he only had 1 year of high school. And you know something? They were right. Now, I'm not going to lie publicly. I don't lie even privately, but I'm not going to lie publicly. First of all, I opened my mouth. You know, I'm not a PhD. Let's not kid each other. So now, if somebody talks about my education, I will say that I only have 1 year of high school. But if I had it to do over again, there's no question I would get my high school diploma. Then it's okay.
They say if you made it to Johnny Carson, you've made the big time. Did you believe that at that time?
Well, you know, it didn't change my life that much. much. I got more recognizable and people talked about me. I have a video of Carl Reiner, who's another friend of mine, being on a Johnny Carson show, and my name came up, and for about 3 or 4 minutes they talked about me, and I wasn't even there. So then the next day I got all these calls saying, hey, Harry, you know, Carl Reiner and Johnny Carson talked about you. So what it was is being more recognizable. It made my work easier. I'm a basically very shy person, like mother, like son. My mother, oh God, if she was standing on a railroad track and a train was coming, she'd be too shy to raise her hand and say help, you know? And when I was a kid in school, kindergarten and first grade, I was too shy to raise my hand when I had to go to the bathroom, for God's sakes. You can see the end result of that. So I really was a very shy kid. Magic saved my life when I saw a counselor doing a card trick and I was too shy to ask him how he did it. Of course, in my mind, he said, oh my God, if I could do that, if I could only do that. I didn't know. He wouldn't tell me how to do it anyway. Magicians don't give away their secrets. But I ran home and I stole milk bottles to get the 2-penny or 3-penny deposits on them in those days so I could buy a cheap deck of cards to try to work out that trick. And that was a plot point for me that changed my life because I had never made eye contact with people. I never spoke to people unless they spoke to me first. Now, suddenly, if I wanted to show this card trick that I just figured out, I had to say at least 3 words. I had to say, pick a card.
Yeah, it was a license to be social with someone.
Yes, it literally changed my life. Magic did, which is why I love magic to this day and why I've written 30 books on this subject, you know. So those things were very important. They were plot points for me, like I told you the Victor Jory stories. I guess I've been very fortunate in my life, Michael.
What's your life look like today? Are you super busy? What are you doing currently?
I'm not super busy, but I'm always writing. I'm writing another magic book as we speak.
Are you writing longhand and cursive?
Always longhand. Excuse me, longhand first and then into the computer, which scares the heck out of me. It took a long time for people to talk me into the computer. Of course, I'm a first-time writer. I don't want to have to write it again once I've typed it. So when I type a chapter, immediately I print it out and I send it to a friend to archive it for me because I'm afraid, you know. But it is easier on a computer than a typewriter. I don't have to use whiteout. I can always change easily if I make a mistake. Although my dyslexia doesn't affect itself that way, I sometimes will write the word hand, H-N-A-D, and I realize it when I do it, I can change it easily on a computer.
You speak so well. I mean, you speak fast and your recall and the memory and the names, it's just incredible.
Well, thank you. My wife tells me I talk too fast sometimes, and perhaps I do, but I'm very succinct, you know. I mean, I make sure people understand me. I write the same way. So, you know, I ran classes personally for a few years here in New York, and I always talked fast, but there was no question that people understood me. So my attitude is talking fast is okay as long as people understand you.
Do you think all the memory, mental exercises, you know, from all your career has maybe staved off any kind of dementia or Alzheimer's or anything like that? What's your personal belief? I'm sure you've thought about it.
I think that mental exercise is very important, Michael. And you hit on a very good point, which I wish I could answer knowingly. Wouldn't that be great? I'd be a savior, for God's sakes. But I don't know. But I got to honestly tell you, I'm knocking wood mentally as I do. I'm not a particularly religious person, but I hedge my bets, so I'm going to knock wood. Maybe that helped me at my age. I'm still mentally okay, because the older I get, the more I hear about old friends and friends of friends who are going into Alzheimer's and dementia and things like that. So I read you that thing from Dr. Steven Zuckerman, who says that my system's helped Alzheimer's patients. So I have a feeling that there is something there, but I'm not a doctor, so I'm very careful about those things. I'm very upset with one thing where you see all these advertisements now about this pill will help your memory. You know, take this medicine and this pill, and that's hogwash. And that I will state definitely, because I'd love for some of these companies to sue me. It's such hogwash. You know, they're going to teach you how to run through a maze like a mouse does. That's what they do. They give these medicines to mice. Maybe in 50 years there will be a pill that will help your memory, but certainly not now, not from the research I've done, and I have done research. Right now, the best over-the-counter pill to give you a memory that you never dreamed possible is me.
The Harry Lorraine pill.
Exactly.
I love it. Well, Harry, I absolutely loved it. You're one of my favorite interviews.
Thank you, but what are you going to do with all that?
I'm going to share it with thousands and thousands of my subscribers. Let's do one more time. Best websites for our students to visit.
Okay. If you want to learn about the Memory Power product alone, just the Memory Power product, you will see Dick Cavett for a moment at the beginning, and you'll have the testimonials and things like that. You'll see a piece of me on the Johnny Carson Show, remembering everybody's name, etc., etc. For that, you go to harrylorraine.com. And Lorraine is spelled L-O-R-A-Y-N-E, harrylorraine.com. If you want a little bit of background of memory, my personal background, etc., and a lot of testimonials, go to memoryimprovement.org. Not .com, but .org. Memoryimprovement.org. And finally, if you want to see a bunch of my things that are not out of print, that are currently available in both the memory and magic area, you got to go to HarryLorraineMagic.com. And in all those cases, from any one of those, you can email me directly if you have any questions. And as I said, I'll answer any question. If I don't want the answer, I'll make it up. It becomes the rule.
You got it. Harry, thank you, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
Good to talk to you, Michael.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
For more interviews like this, go to hardtofindseminars.com.